Accession number 20976, Real 2.
Jeff Scottson, Real 2. You were just telling me how they were telling you to get off the beach.
That's right. We got up on the sand dune, and there was a pillbox there, which some of them attacked. And I believe they had they attacked it with a Churchill and one of these big mortars on it, a very heavy mortar thing. And our second-in-command was wounded there, Bill Cody. He lost an eye on that pillbox, and so he had to get back on the boat and go home because he was bleeding badly. But the majority of us went in across this marsh, because once you was on the sand dune, you dropped down into a marsh that went straight inland, straight south, dead south, towards the town of St. Alban. But when they attacked a pillbox, our troop, as they got to the wooded country, the other side of the marsh, there was a pillbox. And a section of our troop attacked it. One chap was badly wounded in the neck. And they said there was two Germans that ran away from it to our left flank. And we carried on south until we got probably a mile inland. And then our troop left the whole brigade, and we took our captain, who seemed to have been there before. I could have sworn he knew every inch. And we reached the corner of this cornfield, and he took a bearing, compass bearing, and we marched in single file across this open cornfield. We got rid of the flamethrower. We were told to discard the... That's the... off the beat, and is discard the flamethrower and the Bangalore torpedoes. We wouldn't need them anymore, and we made straight for the Pegasus, for Bonneville Bridge. We didn't know it was Pegasus Bridge then, straight across this cornfield, and we reached the village just west of the bridge, and we are in a hollow field, which is now like a caravan camp, and at that time it was a field in a wooded area. And as we reached the edge of this field, on the other side a bloke blew a bugle, and it was one of Major Pine Coffin's men. He was in the airborne, and his job was to meet us. I think he was a captain at the time, but I think he finished up a major. I'm not sure about that. This chap blew a bugle, and out of my pouch I took a Union Jack, which had been given to me the day before, and a big Union Jack, and we all held it like this in front of us, and they blew this bugle, and we met in the middle of this small field, and with that they took us to the bridge, and our troop crossed the bridge. We walked across the bridge single file, and in behind us was the rest of the brigade, which was piped across with Lovett. But we'd gone across, and our task was to go, we didn't know at the time, to get on the high ground towards the Caburg Heights and into a place called Breville, which was a small village. And we got into this villa on the top corner of the village, and there was two or three potholes out in front of in the front garden, round holes that the Germans had already built as air raid places to get in if there was an air raid. In the back room downstairs, the coffee was on the stove, and there was two beds in the back room, and well, we didn't know it at the time, but they knew there was three guns in the wood behind, 105s, and which the second section of our troop was given the task of approaching and attacking these 105s, and there was a 20 millimeter cannon on these 305s, and a big dugout with wooden and grass top, where they used as a air raid shelter, and in the process, a lot of them got wounded badly. This 20 millimeter gun opened up, and we had 23 casualties in about an hour, and we were getting them back towards the bridge again. On the other side of the road there was a farm, and he got a flat truck, a farm truck out, and a horse, and he put the wounded on board and galloped down towards the bridge where there was medics and that, and we never attacked again. We'd reached that, and with about half past four in the afternoon, we were taking some, the last of the wounded that we could move back to the farm in Ampreville, to Bernard Sonia's farm in Ampreville, and the 9th Airborne come over then, landing by parachutes. That was about half past five in the afternoon. Of course, it was difficult to tell because we had double summertime. We started off single summertime, but when we stood to at night, it was almost 11 o'clock each night. It got dark at about 11 because they added another hour on and took it off for the morning. So anyway, see, we were in there a couple of days and dug in that night. The following night, the airborne decided that they were going to have a go at this Breville and come through our lines. And one of the tanks off of the beach came through with them and knocked the wall down behind us. And about half past 10, quarter to 11, they started off across this field. And within an hour, everything came back again. The wounded and wounded Germans and prisoners, they all come back through our lines again. So they decided not to attack that again, because we were told as a unit that we were to hold the ground, because we were the left flank of the British Army, and we were to hold that flank from the beach up as far to nearest Caen as we could until the army was ready to move. And that's what we did. We went on patrols and lost people in the night. We had the first artillery turned up. I think it was I've got a letter in them papers, Joe.
Don't worry about that.
Don't worry about that. And it's a report on this action at 1 o'clock at night, and we got our assault section got ready, and the first shells hit us. Our own shells supposed to be 50 yards in front of us, and one gun fired short, and it, well, ruined the attack. It wounded several, killed one, and so the fire party on the left of us went in and got a prisoner with Sergeant Major Ray. He was our troop sergeant major. And when we left Normandy later on, I must tell you this, we never saw him again. I don't know whether he can't. I think he was in the Indian Army, and he was getting on, but he had no fear. And it was him who went in and brought the prisoner back, and we carried him, half carried him. He was wounded, and we carried our one man that was died, Pop Hook. He was in the Indian Army. And then we found out why we had so many veterinary corps with us, because in front of us was the Villa of Mayor, a stud farm, and there was about 70 mares at a time in foal, and the mayor of Weestrom and Amperville had reserved a field for them to put them in. And we were supposed to get them down, I don't know whether to get them over the bridge, but at least to a meadow out of the way. But I'm afraid that didn't happen. And as the days progressed, I think more and more got killed with the cows and the cattle, and that's how they, the Germans were using them as officers, horses. The Germans were using a lot of horse and carts. Still, with their rations and that, used to come up horse and cart. And by the side of Bernard's farm, there was a passage and there was a smithy, blacksmith there, who used to shoe them all for them. But that's why they tried to get these mares out of this. And in the airborne book called Drop Zone Normandy, I've had it twice from the library. They hadn't got it here, but they got it over the country. Tells you all about this Villa Le Maire, and there was horses that belonged to English owners that were all in a stud farm with French and that were used before the war, and they still remained there, you know, which was quite incredible, really, wasn't it? And then I can't think what date it was. We moved forward. We left Bernard's farm. A lot of the Germans retreated to a certain distance, and we went up into the Boris of Bavant, which was further on towards Paris, I suppose, but in the Cabourg Heights. And we held the line there for a while. The airborne had been in there, and there was Canadians there before us. And we used to get a lot of trouble with mortars. If our artillery opened up, the German mortars would open up under the noise of our guns. They used to get messages back, can we have a picnic in the wood, or is the teddy bear still there? The radio used to radio messages such as that, you know, because they were prepared to mortar us if they got artillery attack themselves. And then gradually he moved back, and there was a devil of a battle one night towards the end of our stay there, and our artillery opened up. Must have been 12 hours of it we had of artillery fire when the Germans was going through the Falaise Gap and being caught by our artillery. But we didn't go with that on the road to Paris. We cleared the coastline all the way along to Trouville and Deauville, all along to towards the mouth of the Seine, almost to the mouth of the Seine. But that was our job. And when we got there, we formed up one day, and they brought three tonners up. We came back to England. That was September, middle of September, and the idea was we were going to go to Burma, and we came back and trained under Marine officers and bridge building and all that sort of thing, ready for Burma.
What condition were you in when you got back?
Not bad at all. Not bad at all. We'd lost about half our men in the process while we were over there, but we'd had reinforcements all the time. We kept getting reinforcements from Acna Carry. The Green Howards were the first reinforcements we had, and then they started getting through from Acna Carry. And that's how we kept the numbers of the troops up. And so we weren't too bad. We were about 50 men to each troop, that was, I suppose. And we came back to Gosport in one of them tank ships with the doors at the front. Unloaded at Gosport and went to Petworth, in camp at Petworth. And were given leave from there and came back to Brighton. But it was decided, I don't think they wanted to, but but the Germans broke through the Ardennes. So Meals Roberts took the first commander brigade back to France. And Peter Young took the 3rd Army Brigade to Burma, because they give us all white boiler suits. We'd had tropical gear given to us, and we had to hand all that in, and they give us white boiler suits like painters, and sheepskin waistcoats, anything to keep us warm. And we had the coldest winter of the war. Well, it was finished the Germans in Russia, didn't it? And it was cold, and we went to get there. They took us to London, to what's the name of the? Can't think of the name of the port in London, and we went by ferry. We got on a ferry that had run before the war, and went to Ostend, straight across to Ostend, off this ferry in the Thames, and we went into barracks just outside the harbour in Ostend, and we spent about 3 nights there while they arranged a train, and they took us down through Belgium to a convent, and it's all in the one book I read, and we went to this woman. She was in charge, this nun was in charge of all, about 180 she had. Not quite well in the head, lads. Some of them were quite big. And she covered this marble floor in this place with straw, and we bedded down in this convent for a couple of nights until they found out, and we went to the Mars with Elmont, and then the Mars, and we finished up bitter cold on this Mars. Frozen over it was. Germans one side of it and us the other. And we had a patrol that went from where we had billeted in this house with no roof towards the riverbank through these woods. And we'd have 3 men at a time in a little slit trench on the edge of the river with a couple of primer stoves, paraffin stoves, and then a trench with the rest of the section back. And they do about 20 minutes at a time, and several got frostbite fingers, and Cliff Morris, he got frostbite in his toes and fingers there. It was cold. And they used to send us every week to a drift mine, the last one in Europe it was, at Sittard. And we used to have a change of long johns and thick vests. As you went in, you took everything off, went into this shower room at the top of this pit, and have a hot shower. It was beautiful, it was, and then come out the other end and put clean flannelette underwear on, and got nice and dry for a change. Yeah.
Were you still with Three Troop?
Three Troop, yeah. And then what did we do? We took over near Lynn, a place called Lynn, Maasbracht in Holland, South Holland, and we took over from the 3rd American Army. They marched out, and we marched in, and we took over from them when we started night patrols. And we had our tanks painted white, and they stayed down in the woods all day. And then at night they'd come back, and we'd go down there in the wood, and we couldn't dig in. It was too cold, too hard, the ground. And the snow left us while we were there, it remained hard. You couldn't make a slit trench or anything. And we got strapped one night. A German patrol came through, and they had a bazooka. There was about 6 of them, and this chap fired this bazooka over the top and wounded. We had a lieutenant, he'd been wounded 3 times. He'd come back that day, and and a chap named Huey White, who was in our troop, took him over and said, "Put your gear down there. I shouldn't unpack," he said. "Officers don't last long." And that night he got wounded with us. Got it. And I've met him since, and we spoke all about it. And
was that true, that officers didn't last long?
They didn't, no, because they were always in the front line. Always went with us. Never fought from the rear. And a chap named, what's his name? Big fella from, and I came down when Coventry played Brighton years and years ago. But he finished up and he was a writer for the police at Crawley and lived with his daughter, and he died about 2 years ago. I can't think of his name. And this bazooka exploded and it took the muscles off both of his legs. And he came back and he was offered a job in East Street, Brighton, diamond cutting, or a projectionist at the cinema, A Granada in Portland Road. But when he went home, he said, "No, I'm gonna get off home." And that's why Reed, Big Freddie Reed, that was him. And he just died about 18 months ago up at Crawley. Yeah. And he was with us that night. And then they retreated, the Germans retreated, and we followed them. Two or three of officers got killed. One night they went out, and the officer that I was, he'd gone to four troop, and his name was Leopard, and Spot we used to call him, naturally. And he went out with an officer named Hugo with a patrol early morning, and he went a bit too far, and they got killed. And his brother turned out as our CO for some time, and they were a whole family. And when he died out in where the Buddhist monks live. Where is it? Well, I can't think of the country. And he became a Buddhist, and it was in the Argus about 2 years ago now. Anybody that remembers Captain Major Eddie Leopard, I beg your pardon. And would they please note that he died in, I can't think where it was, Malaya,
Thailand.
Pardon?
Thailand.
And he'd been buried in a monastery there, or whatever. And Eddie Leopard. And they were an old family. In fact, I've got a book there with the battery at King Alfred, that's just down the road here, and the Leopard's father's in it. He was in the battery between the two wars. Yeah, and these two were on. I was Spots. He was with Pyman, who was our captain, and Leopard, the younger, was his second in command, and the third officer in our troop to the end of Normandy was Cahoon, and that he came from a family on the Loch Lomond, a very rich family. They were sheriffs. Somebody told me that if you divide Scotland across the middle from Edinburgh, from east to west, and divide what you've got left at the top, his family owned all one side of Scotland. Yeah. And Cahoon. And I met him after, about 10 years ago. He came across, and I'd said to him, he was just like Humpty Dumpty. He got ever so fat, far fatter than I, and he was only a little short man. One day when we was down here, down on the front, we came in from the harbour about 10 o'clock at night, one November, and the boats got stuck on the sandbar, and the heavy weapons troop was firing over our heads as we came in, and they were firing parachute flares and lighting the sea up. And he jumped off the ramp and disappeared. And his spirit floated down in the sea, and at this point, because someone shouted it from the beach. And it was Bill Code, and he said, I didn't want you, he stuttered ever so bad, Bill Code, and he said, I didn't want you to get off the boat yet. He said, I just wanted to know if you were ready. And that's what happened. And he had to wait all the way out again until he was told to start the exercise. And they had Americans with them. And they were showing, because we'd had the fire escape, fire escape from Brighton Fire Brigade, underneath Black Rock, where the big marina is built. And we were trying to demonstrate how it would be better for them if they could get up underneath the, like Ponder Hock, where the Americans landed, get underneath the cliff and come up, and you won't be under fire until you actually put your head over the top. Yet they brought the Americans along here to show them that you were under fire all the way in. I think about his name in a minute, lives down there now. He used to be on the breakfast television and newspaper correspondent. He lives in one of these, the castle, right? The tops are like castles, concrete, built on the beach. And we used to have, in the Deep Sea Anglers next door, was our demolition store, because we used to keep all our 808 and gelignite and all that sort of stuff in this store for safety on the beach. And that's all been built up again, all in brickwork. So
coming back to the Low Countries, you said you were in Maasbracht.
Yeah.
What happened
and we
at
went,
Maasbracht?
We went from Maasbracht. The Red Ball Express, have you ever heard of them? Well, this is in the war, American Negroes weren't allowed to be in the fighting mob. They were transport, and they were known as the Red Ball Express. And they used to have these three-axled General Motors trucks with seats in, and wherever anybody wanted to go, they called the Red Ball Express. They never had their own heavy transport, and they come and picked us up, and they took us onto the Maginot Line. And we went further.
Maginot Line?
Yeah, right down. And we were right by the side of the Rhine in the end. And we crossed where is it, Joe? Where did we cross the Rhine? Wesel, yeah. And that, we were there for 3 weeks on the side of the Rhine under Montgomery's smoke screen. These canisters burning smoke. And the strange thing was, all the time we were there, that smoke drifted back to the German side. We never once got it in our faces. And it was the most spectacular event that I'd seen in the war. We went down to the riverbank about 10:30 at night, and the boats had been put there, and they were all folded. Canvas and wood folded boats. The majority of our commando went further down near the bridges at Wesel, but we were upstream. And our troop, we had boxes with outboard engines and these canvas boats. And I went across with the RSM and this Huey Wyatt. We got about 100 feet off the shore and the engine was racing, but the propeller wasn't going round. We come back, they got like lumps of conduit with pieces of metal welded onto them in the bottom of the boat to row yourself back. We had to get another engine, because the cotter pin had broken the propeller. And eventually reached the other side. And three commando was coming along the bank from further upstream where they had landed and meeting us. And the Germans come in the other side. It was quite a mess for a while, but we made ourselves down. What I was going to tell you was, before we went across, and the artillery had been firing all evening, all of a sudden a plane approached. It was dead quiet, and a plane approached, and it was a mosquito, you could see it. And it went right over Faisal and dropped a flare. And as the flare come down, there was a groan in the sky, and there was 20 Lancasters, one after the other, came across, one at a time, and dropped their bombs right in the centre of Wessel. When we got there, I suppose midnight, there wasn't an house standing. It was just a wilderness. And we stayed there all night until about 10 the next morning. And the airborne come over. And it was what was left of all different units. There was Americans and the rest of number one, whatever there was left, landed on top of us in all this smoke screen that was still burning behind us. So it was all covered in smoke, and there was planes being hit and coming down. And for about 3 hours it was a real mess until it all quietened down. And then we started off inland, and